You're listening to a 3CR podcast created in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.
Green Left Weekly Radio.
There's one newspaper that is independent of powerful capitalist interests, and that is Green Left Weekly.
It's the people's voice, committed to human and civil rights, ecological sustainability, democracy and equality. It presents ideas that the mainstream media won't.
Green Left is a leading source of local, national and international news with analysis, discussion and debate to strengthen the anti-capitalist movement.
It helps expose the lies of the capitalist press and puts the voices of the marginalised and the oppressed at the centre of fighting for a better world and helps us understand the political developments unfolding around us.
Good morning, listeners. You're listening to Green Left Radio on 3CR 855 AM. And you're joined today by myself, Jacob Andrewafer, as one of your presenters. And I'm also joined by two other great co-presenters.
Hello. Sorry, my name's Stephanie. And next to me is...
Mary.
Yay.
Good morning, everyone.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to our last show for the year. Unfortunately, there's been... a bit happening over the last week, but we'll dive into that in a moment. But yeah, we do want to make it a time to reflect and kind of celebrate some of the highlights of the year. But also there's, obviously some tragic events that have happened recently too.
Okay, so before we get into the nitty-gritty, 3CR and Green Left recognise that this show is being broadcasted from the land of the Wurundjeri Woiwurrung. They are the original, the rightful, sovereign owners. They're the storytellers and caretakers of this land. Australia was founded on the attempted genocide and dispossession of its first people. And we recognise that this attempted genocide is ongoing. As socialists, we pledge to actively support decolonisation. We stand with all the first peoples in their struggle for justice and right to their land.
Thanks for that, Mary. So to go into a bit of a rundown on what we have coming up on the program, just to also let listeners know, while this is our last live-to-air program this year, we will have a period of summer programming happening over the next 3 weeks, and a bit of a shout-out to one of our presenters, Jordan, who is currently getting that prepared. We'll have 3 weeks of summer program from the 26th of December, the 2nd of December, and the 9th of January. And our summer programming will probably feature a range of kind of talks and content from this year's Eco-Socialism Conference, and we might also include recordings and other highlights from the year. Typically for our summer programming, we usually use some pre-existing stuff from our from previous conferences that are being held, but also sometimes we've also, like for 1 year, we also did like some classic speeches, like, you know, sometimes we've had recordings of Fidel Castro, and so on, hope listeners enjoy that, and we'll be back to a live to air program on the 16th of January, the 16th of January will be our first live to air program. We'll be back in 2026, so just hope all our listeners have a good holiday and a good break over the years, but keep tuning in to Green Left Radio over the next 3 weeks, because we do have some quality summer programming happening.
Definitely, and some of the other fantastic shows on 3CR as well.
Okay, so going into the first news story, and obviously this has been, dominating the kind of headlines, and it's really hard not to kind of think about this, but the horrifying kind of events are at Bondi Beach, where more than 15 people were killed by a shooter at a Chinooka by the sea event on December the 14th. I would like to extend all 3CR and Green Left Radio would like to extend all the solidarity to the victims of those killings, and that, you know, we absolutely don't want to kind of downplay the tragedy of this event, even as, you know, and something that we will be commenting on, you know, even as politicians, and especially right-wing politicians like One Nation and the Bob Catter, I forgot what his party was called, but attempting to kind of exploit the event for their own gain and, you know, to actually drive, you know, racism and, you know, attack the Palestine Solidarity Movement and so on. And I think that is definitely something we have to be aware of.
But also people like Josh Frydenberg.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. But maybe I'll go, I have my own sort of comments on the event, but I guess I wanted to see if Mary or Steph want to kind of start off with some of their reflections.
Yeah, I mean, I've got loads. I sort of put together some of my thoughts, and it's not entirely coherent, my thoughts around this, but I do feel like it's so important to come from a place of empathy and compassion for the grieving families and grieving community, and just the... I guess, you know, this is like a really significant terrorist attack on you know, so-called Australian soil, but it has an impact on community safety and felt sense of safety, and I think that needs to be acknowledged as well. And, you know, in saying that, of course, it's quite concerning some of the ramifications that may come out from this, but before going into that, I just wanted to speak to a couple of things. So I guess, yeah, I totally hear what Jacob is saying, and just, yeah, the strength of solidarity and how that can bring people together across, you know, religious and ethnic divides, and just how powerful that is. And we, you know, we see that time and time again in times of crisis, like even in Lebanon, you know, I think it was last year when there were... Christian Lebanese, I think, taking in Muslim Lebanese, or it might have been the other way around. But, yeah, it's just who would normally, you know, kind of have a bit of animosity towards each other sometimes. So, yeah, you know, there's a huge amount of strength in the human spirit, in the way that people band together in times of crisis. And then, of course, there's the actions of Ahmed Al-Ahmed, and just who is
Syrian Muslim
man who risked his life to disarm one of the gunmen. And, you know, that just act of pure bravery and just concern and care for his fellow human beings, I think demonstrates the kind of world that we all want to live in, one without fear, but one where we see each other as human beings first and foremost. And... yeah, and I was just sort of thinking as well about just this time of year, and it's a really significant time for people of so many different faiths, and even people who don't practice any religion. Like, we've got, you know, the start of a new calendar year. We've got Hanukkah, which of course was the event that the victims were celebrating. Hanukkah by the sea, and then we've got Christmas, of course. There's also Bodhi Day in Buddhism, there's the Epiphany, and then, you know, more traditional or pagan celebrations of Yule and Midsummer. And I was just sort of thinking how, you know, just it's so important to hold on to the best of religion and what it has to offer people, but not, you know, sometimes I think fundamentalism can just be dangerous in any form, like, and... hence, we've got this example with the shooters who were, yeah, linked to ISIS and motivated by, yeah, extremism. And, of course, like we've seen in Palestine, mass murder of Palestinians by Israel. So I think, you know, it doesn't matter what religion or what ideology, if you lose sight of humans being humans and, you know, equal worth and dignity, then I think... it really sets us up for a dangerous,
Can I just say, I think the example of New Zealand after the mass shooting there of Muslims doing almost the same thing as what was happening at Bondi Beach, which is practicing their religion peacefully, and the shooter comes in and just murders people. And the example there, I think, was a really positive one, especially from the Prime Minister down. Whereas I have the impression here in Australia that in the religious realm, there is much more unity and coming together. But the political side, we've got the ultra-right, as you said, Pauline Hanson and even Bob Katter, but also people like Josh Frydenberg and the Liberals are using this, weaponizing it, which I just find is really, really disgusting.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah, I guess I wanted to kind of add into that kind of discussion as well, because, I mean, yes, definitely I would, it's definitely like the Liberal Party and the extreme right are definitely trying to exploit this event. But I also would have to, I want to probably bring a bit of a critique of the Albanese government into this because and the state Labor governments, because, okay, now on one hand, I would say that the Albanese government is actually playing quite, you know, they're playing this quite carefully in a sense. So, for example, they are kind of in a, they are kind of doing the right things, like, you know, Albanese visited the what's the man's name again?
Ahmed Al-Mari.
So there was that. They're talking about things like, you know, gun control, etc. You know, those are all kind of progressive things that you would not kind of, I guess, support in response to a kind of crisis like this. And but at the same time, they're sort of trying to sneak in a few other things as well at the same time that are fundamentally right-wing and essentially represent an attack on the Palestine Solidarity Movement.
Yeah.
They're almost sneakily trying to connect this event by saying, because Albanese, to his credit, is not saying this directly. Right. He is playing the smart politician game. And basically he's saying things like, okay, yes, I support all the recommendations of the Gillian Siegel kind of report into anti-Semitism, which is actually framed around the idea that the Palestine Solidarity Movement is inherently anti-Semitic, which I think we absolutely have to reject. And then they're also talking about restrictions on protests, etc. Then the Chris Minns government is also talking about, oh yes, we need to start arming this Jewish security company that has links to the IDF. So there's all these sort of things that are kind of happening as well. I guess the other thing as well is I want to kind of add on, I guess my sort of understanding of best about the roots, I think, of this violence, because do you think that this event does, you know, fit into a kind of direction, I think, of, I guess, the kind of is quite revealing, I think, of the nature of capitalism. Because, I mean, at the end of the day, obviously, from the perspective of global North governments, of a lot of these capitalist governments, there is a bit of the sense of selective empathy, in a sense that they're all very much, you know, they're giving their condolences to the victims of the Bondi Massacre, all that, but of course none of that has been given to the victims of the genocide in Palestine, but it also hasn't necessarily been given to the victims of other genocides and other massacres that are happening around the world. Like, think about, you know, what's happening in Sudan, what's happening in the Democratic Republic of Congo. Ultimately, we are living in a world where violence like this is becoming increasingly normalised. You know, these random acts of violence, you know, the fact that all the liberal kind of Western liberal democracies have normalized the genocide in Gaza, openly kind of supported it. And then you have the violence that's happening in Sudan and Congo. I mean, all this violence is structurally linked to the nature of the capitalist system and how the capitalist system is pushing and normalizing this kind of violence. Because essentially, when you think about the implications, you know, of the 2 years of the Gaza genocide, it essentially is this idea that almost anything goes, anything can be, justified. And I think the fact that the shooters have been linked to ISIS is actually also important to note as well, because, I mean, at the end of the day, ISIS are a reactionary far-right group that is essentially fascist in nature. And I think also some things that listeners might not be aware of, but ISIS is actually fundamentally opposed to Palestine. While they might give some rhetoric about supporting Palestine national self-determination, they essentially have a policy of being opposed to the Palestinian resistance. And in fact, both Hamas, Hezbollah, Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, the policy that ISIS would have to all those groups, which are all represent, you know, different facets of the Palestinian resistance, would be to shoot them on sight. Like that's yeah. that's the kind of element of of ISIS. And yeah, I think it's they very much reflect the kind of violence, because the roots of ISIS very much come from, you know, the US's intervention and invasion of Iraq, you know, the instability of Syria. So yeah, I think definitely this violence and this killing has to be very much contextualized around that. But I also think we absolutely have to condemn, you know, politicians who are attempting to exploit this, especially how Israel has attempted to exploit this because as soon as this started, Netanyahu tried to link this to Australians' recognition of Palestine.
And also Ahmed al-Ahmed.
A Jew. Yes.
It's just, totally incorrect.
Well, crazy. But also linking it to allowing the Palestine movement to demonstrate. I just want to quote something that Albanese said yesterday. He started off by saying that he was concerned by some of the language used at pro-Palestine demonstrations. And then he went on and said, when people come to Australia, you have to leave old divisions and hatred at the door. When you come to Australia, you are here to support our society, which is diverse, but that diversity is a strength. So, you know, that might sound innocuous, but what about, so are we saying that people that come to Australia are not allowed to go to Palestine protests or to protests about what's happening in Sudan or maybe about to happen in Venezuela? So what about people that were born in Australia? Are we allowed to do those things?
It's very assimilationist and very authoritarian, actually. Like, and I think, Jacob and Mary are absolutely right on this one. I also just wanted to highlight too, though, that like Zionism has been so conflated with Judaism, and it's so problematic because Judaism, there's many strengths to it, and there's many people who are Jewish who are really outspoken critics. And I just wanted to touch on one person in particular because he's I work with victim survivors of trauma, and the person that I'm referring to is Gabor Maté, who is a Holocaust survivor, Hungarian-Canadian physician, and he's also a leading expert on trauma. And he sort of, there's a fantastic YouTube video on how he, was initially raised to believe and condone Zionism, as a lot of Jewish people are, and as, you know, pretty much all Israelis are. And I think that's the other thing that I wanted to highlight here as well. It's just, it is really hard to challenge your beliefs if that's all that you've ever known. But it's so important that people go on that journey, I think. So, I've got a quote from him here, actually, that I just wanted to share because I think it's just really quite powerful. His main contention is that it talks about the role that trauma, like mass trauma from the Holocaust and centuries of anti-Semitism, plays in Zionism, and how this is exploited by, well, first the British and its allies, and then by Israel as it was formed. So this quote, from someone with deep connections to the history of this situation, the warmth that Jews have for Israel, I used to be in that same camp. I can understand, after the horrors of the Nazi genocide, how we desperately want some protection. I can understand all that, but none of the excuses what we are doing, none of that excuses what we are doing. There are no two sides in terms of power and control, and it's pretty straightforward. There was a land with a people living there, and other people wanted it. They took it over, and they continue to take it over, and they continue to discriminate, oppress, and dispose that other people. So, I think that's really important.
That's not a great quote.
Yeah. It's interesting too because I found the Reddit can be a wild place, but just, just sort of reading the whole justification of Zionism and just, they will always come back to, it's self-protection and it's two sides. And well, genocide isn't two sides. You know, there's a primary aggressor, and there's it's an apartheid system, and it has been from the get-go. Yep.
Well, maybe we can finish off this discussion, and maybe we'll play a bit. We'll play a song. Just one last thing I'd like to add is one thing we will have to be aware of is, in addition to, you know, the government attempting to repress our right to protest, we also have to be wary about how the far right is going to be kind of organising in response to this event. And in fact, I think there is definitely going to be some heightened kind of tensions. There's already, I think, a far right sort of anti-Muslim protest being called on January 27. There also potentially might be a small thing organised this Sunday. So I think, yeah, we'll have to be something we'll have to pay attention to in terms of, you know, how the reactionary right are going to kind of exploit these events to advance their own kind of agenda. And I think, yeah, at Green Left Radio and 3CR, we obviously will be at the forefront of, you know, presenting anti-fascist and anti-racist perspectives and actually countering, you know, the kind of reactionary politics of the far right.
Yeah, and that's anti-racism for all groups.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely. All right, well, I'm just going to go play, I thought I'd go play Scott Street by Phoebe Bridgers, which is, you know, pretty melancholic song that will kind of fit the kind of sober mood of the kind of discussion that we're sort of having. So yeah, you're listening to Green Left Radio on 3CR 855 AM.
Scott Street, feeling like a stranger, with an open heart, open container. I've got a stack of mail and a tall can. It's a shower, beer, it's a payment plan. There's helicopters over. Getting married.
All right. You're listening to Green Left Radio on Free CR 855 AM. And you're just listening to Scott Street by Phoebe Bridges. Now, the next thing that we're going to play for this part of the program is we thought that we would play a recording of a talk by Ben Radford. So Ben Radford has actually been a regular guest on Green Left Radio, specifically talking about politics in Latin America. And as part of the Rising Tide blockade, he gave this fantastic sort of presentation that's kind of like a good one to kind of end the year on. And that is talking about this question around eco-socialism and decolonization, because I guess at Green Left Radio, you know, Green Left Radio is, you know, unashamedly, we are an eco-socialist program. You know, we advocate for eco-socialist solutions to the climate crisis, to the issues of exploitation, for First Nations sovereignty and so on. So this talk very much goes into a kind of lot of those themes. And then after this, we'll probably play another song and then go into another kind of news story drawn in from the pages of Green Left. So yeah, hope listeners enjoy. This will be playing for the next 17 minutes. You're listening to Green Left Radio.
All right, well, welcome everyone. Maybe I'll just start with introducing eco-socialism. I guess maybe it's not a term that everyone's familiar with, but it basically comes from drawing on all this knowledge of ecology that we have of, you know, ecological systems, biological systems, how that all functions, you know, climate systems, stuff like that, combined with socialist analyses and theories, which I guess basically encapsulated is that capitalism as the sort of dominant economic and social system is essentially incompatible with social justice and, you know, I guess sustainable human habitation on this earth. So, you know, it comes from that the struggle for land and particularly Indigenous land, First Nations land, that struggle is inseparable from, you know, an anti-capitalist struggle. And I think, you know, I'd like to reference Hugo Blanco, who's a really famous Peruvian revolutionary, who's also considered one of the sort of pioneering eco-socialists. And his approach was basically, you know, he tells an anecdote where if you were to talk to maybe your average Peruvian and you said, oh, hey, are you an eco-socialist? They would say, oh, like, you know, piss off, or what's that? Like, I don't understand what that means. But he says, if you look at all of these diverse struggles in, you know, not just Peru, but all across the continent and all across the world, that basically a lot of people are eco-socialists, you know, in the struggles to defend communities from mining or to, you know, to stop deforestation on their land. That is essentially an eco-socialist struggle in the sense that it's resisting this sort of constant exploitation and destruction. That's basically the profit-seeking logic under capitalism, even if they wouldn't necessarily articulate it and say, you know, I'm an eco-socialist. But, you know, his approach was basically saying, like, resistance to that system, you know, can be recognized as an eco-socialist struggle, even if it's not particularly identified as that. And I guess to, you know, provide a bit of historical context to that, and I mean, I'd recommend everyone, if you don't know who Hugo Blanco is, that sort of look him up. He's basically led, had a big part in leading sort of peasant uprisings in Peru, particularly for agrarian reform, as well as all over the continent. He was in Chile when Salvador Allende was overthrown and installed basically a US-backed military dictatorship. And, you know, he basically for his entire life was very deeply involved in these grassroots and, you know, what he was very certain were eco-socialist struggles. And especially if we look at the Latin American context, where it's a continent that for, you know, 500 years, for centuries and centuries has essentially been an epicenter of colonial extraction, you know, from the arrival of the Spanish or the Portuguese in Brazil and, you know, various other colonial powers, but mostly the Spanish. Latin America was basically colonized with the express intent of extracting primary resources, whether that is minerals, for example, the huge silver mines in Bolivia, or it was deforesting land to have huge plantations. That was basically the development trajectory of Latin America. And, you know, even now, even though technically Latin America is no longer under imperial rulers, basically there was long independent struggles waged, and basically to the point where countries were declared independent, but, you know, the means of production, the big landowners was still controlled by a rich elite, often, you know, geared to the international sort of established capitalist market. And, you know, we still see that now reflected in the terms of world trade, where basically most of the economies of Latin America are primarily export based. So whether it be agricultural products like soybeans or corn or whatever it may be, or minerals. So Peru's biggest export is copper. Most Latin American countries are still primary sites of extraction, which then these primary products are exported to other countries, mostly industrialized countries of the global north, that are then, you know, made into products that's where the value is added, because basically primary resources are cheap. So industrialized countries essentially add all of the value and therefore the profits. And in a lot of cases, these same products which were taken from these countries of Latin America are then sold back into these economies at, you know, triple, quadruple, whatever, because then they're considered value added products. And we've also, particularly that was deepened even further under, I'm sure many of you have heard of structural adjustment programs, which was basically a huge neoliberal push in the 80s and 90s, which essentially worked to privatize any sort of state-owned companies, sort of implement these huge austerity programs as conditional to receiving loans for these economies of, well, not just Latin America, but all over the world. And so as a result, it really like implemented even further this logic of extractivism, essentially opened up a lot of these economies even more to private capital, to transnational corporations. And so that's, you know, that's something that that people in Latin America are resisting. So, for example, in Ecuador, we've basically got a really powerful indigenous-led social movement there. It's called CONAI, and it essentially stands for the Confederation of Indigenous Nationalities of Ecuador. And for those of you who haven't heard, they're probably the most powerful social movement in Ecuador. And they've been organizing since the 70s and 80s, but they particularly came to prominence in the 90s in the middle of this real sort of neoliberal assault. And they have, you know, been powerful enough to bring down governments and even to win huge concessions from governments. So, for example, they've brought down three different neoliberal governments, essentially waged a huge resistance against whenever governments have really tried to implement austerity measures. Like, say, a really big one in Ecuador is every now and again a government will try and eliminate the diesel subsidy, which basically has been in place for many years and essentially makes the cost of everything cheaper, because, you know, diesel is used for machinery for farming. It's, you know, obviously a big part of the transport sector. Like, it feeds into many different basic living costs. And so it's obviously something that a lot of people, it directly impacts them. And so when that is threatened, there's always a huge resistance to it. And so such to the point that when there's been national strikes that have gone on for, a week, 2 weeks at a time, pretty much in every case, the government has had to walk back from the attempts to basically eliminate the diesel subsidy. And in Ecuador, it's quite not necessarily completely unique to Latin America, but it has a history of this real sort of strength in particularly the indigenous highland communities. There's a real solidarity between these communities, and this confederation is made up of hundreds of other indigenous organizations, who it's essentially sort of, if you touch one of us, you touch us all. Like, it's not that if something directly impacts just your community, then you will resist it. It's this huge nationwide network of solidarity, essentially, which I think is such an important example, and can't be applied to all contexts, but I think is definitely a really powerful example of a decolonial struggle or struggle for decolonization that I think we can definitely learn a lot from as socialists, or anyone who's interested in resisting the frontier of resource extraction, which we all know is completely intertwined with the climate crisis, and it's also, I think, an important aspect of that is also resisting some of the false solutions that we've seen, particularly a lot of the sort of top-down, like corporate imposed solutions that supposedly are going to be the next big fix for the climate crisis. I think a big one has been, for example, the RED scheme, which was essentially set up to create all these carbon mechanisms. So basically looking at the world's forests and saying, oh, well, if we pay someone to protect them, then it means that someone can pollute elsewhere, because then that is offset by those existing forests. And even if, there's so many problematic things about it, but even with some, NGOs that particularly might have good intentions of trying to protect forests from being deforested, what it's actually meant is in a lot of places it's reproduced this exact sort of colonial logic, which, you've had cases where indigenous communities are living in a forest area or a forest biome, and an NGO has come and essentially gone, hey, this is now a protected area, so you're not allowed to fish or hunt or do anything because that would potentially affect the, carbon generating potential of this area. So we've seen under these sort of schemes, lots of land grabs, lots of dispossession that's been in the name of conservation. So, it's bad enough that people are getting kicked off their land for, mining projects and for oil projects, but then that it's also happening in the name of supposedly conservation really goes to show that sort of, Western neo-colonial logic has pervaded even the mechanism that was supposedly meant to, advance protections for the climate and for indigenous communities. I guess, do you want me to keep talking maybe about, you got anything?
Maybe we can wrap it up like,
okay, yep. Maybe. I did have some notes, but okay, maybe we'll bring it back to Australia. I think a really important struggle that we've reported on as Green Left, the media organization that I'm a part of, I think, and is a really sort of crucial example of the struggle for decolonization, which is obviously what this discussion is about, and it's the fight over in WA. Basically, on the Burrup Peninsula, or Murujuga. We basically had all of this organisation from First Nations groups there, particularly led by Raylene Cooper, who's a super staunch First Nations woman, who was one of the co-founders of Save Our Songlines, which is basically this group that is trying to protect the Burrup Peninsula from basically being destroyed by fossil fuel companies, so Woodside, to build fertilizer plants and fossil fuel projects, basically with no consent whatsoever from the local traditional custodians. And basically what they're trying to protect as well is their cultural sites, which this area has the biggest collection of petroglyphs, so like rock art, in the world. There's over 2 million unique cultural artifacts there, and basically they're going to destroy all of that to make way for these fertilizer projects, and have already started destroying it. And you know, this is more than 60,000 years of history, of identity. People don't go and like, I don't want to make it's not the best comparison, because it doesn't even factor in the richness of Aboriginal history in this country. But say if someone went to the Louvre in Paris, which is considered important cultural and historical and site, that's if someone went, oh look, I want to build something there, so I'm just going to knock this down and that's it. But like, you know, that doesn't even cover the extent of what's at stake here, of what's going to be destroyed. And so there's been a huge fight over there, and a huge fight in also highlighting Australia's role and Australia's complicity in being one of the biggest fossil fuel exporters in the world, right? Coal, gas, and this comes with huge consequences for not just, you know, First Nations people in Australia and Australians, but this also, you know, creates injustice all around the world. You know, this is being exported to India, this is being exported to all these places that then have their own local specific effects, as well as, you know, contributing to the global climate crisis, which, you know, we're basically heading to a tipping point. And so I guess, you know, one thing to highlight is the resistance here is a form of international solidarity. You know, what we stop from happening here, we stop from occurring, you know, around the world as well.
Okay, you're listening to Green Left Radio on 3CR 855 AM. And I'm gonna get Mary to introduce a song around the kind of Christmas theme, because we are going into Christmas. In fact, Christmas is actually next week, next Thursday. So Salt would play a song, and I'll get Mary to kind of introduce it.
This is a song that I think most listeners will know of if they haven't heard it, and it's John Lennon and Yoko Ono's Christmas song. It's from October 1971, but I think it's still really good.
All right. Well, I hope listeners enjoy. You're listening to Green Left Radio.
Happy Christmas, Julian. So this is Christmas, and what have you done? Another year over, and you won't just be gone. And so this is Christmas, I hope you have fun. The near and the dear ones, the old and the young,
a very Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year. Let's hope it's a good one without any fear.
And so this is Christmas, for we
can fall strong. The rich and the poor ones. The road is so long. And so
all right, you're listening to Green Left Radio on Free CR 855 AM. And you're just listening to Happy Christmas by John Lennon and Yoko Ono. So I want to go start off, a bit of a kind of discussion, actually. Actually drawing on an article that has been published in Green Left. And I think this is actually a good segue following the kind of talk that we had by Ben Radford, where he was talking about eco-socialism and the struggle for decolonization. But one of the big kind of ecological concerns that socialists need to be kind of conscious about and actually follow very closely is this whole question around the whole artificial intelligence data center boom, which, as has been written by Olivia and Isaac Nellis, is very much driving huge energy and water consumption. And they write here that as society is becoming more reliant on digital technology, the demand for storage and network bases to deal with transferring vast amounts of data is growing. For most, data is stored in the cloud. So, you know, we're living in this kind of period where, you know, a lot of us are using a lot of our data being stored on cloud servers, etc. But this is a kind of metaphor. The metaphor of the cloud actually masks the fact that it is actually far more resource intensive and in its impact insidious physical reality. The huge tracts of data that make up everything from music streaming platforms to complex artificial intelligence systems have to be stored in physical hardware. This includes millions of hard disk drives and solid state drives integrated into servers and massive storage array. A data center refers to when these physical systems are grouped and together and housed in a single location. And I guess another element about this is these data centers, you know, all the convenience that we have with the internet and, you know, our streaming services, like even Netflix, for example, you know, these data centers require constant power, intensive cooling and complex networking to guarantee 24/7 access. And of course, this is leading to massive and increasing energy and water consumption, which then contributes to greenhouse gas emissions. It also places substantial stress on local utility infrastructure and climate commitments. So how does this all link with artificial intelligence? So corporate class in Australia is fighting for a monopoly, and according to ABC Economics correspondent Michael Jander, business spending on new data centres was a substantial contributor to the 2% growth recorded in the July-September quarter, with businesses spending on machinery and equipment ramping up by 7.6%. And right now, there's a bubble happening, and basically a lot of investment is rapidly being geared towards AI. And of course, as a result of this, because artificial intelligence actually requires even more data, it requires even more power, then it requires even more than just simply streaming films or music to listeners and consumers. We've already seen more than 260 data centers have already been established across Australia, with dozens more on the pipeline. And of course, these currently consume about 2% of the national electricity grid. And of course, the Australian Energy Market Operator expects that to rise to 6% by 2030 and 12% by 2050. Of this, about 60% powers the servers themselves, while the rest powers cooling systems and other infrastructure. Now, all this is kind of like, powering cooling systems and other, all this is driving up energy consumption significantly, and really the global demand is growing four times faster than other economic centers. And we're seeing this happen in the United States and China, south and their hubs in Southeast Asia, particularly Singapore and southern Malaysia. And of course, we're having all these major tech company players like OpenAI, the company behind AI chatbot ChatGPT. They're vesting. We already have the Victorian government committing at least $5.5 million in a bid to establish the state as Australia's data center capital. And OpenAI is also the primary tenant in a $70 billion data center being built in Western Sydney, which is set to be the largest in the southern hemisphere. So yeah, I mean, I think I have kind of more to kind of say on this, but actually, does some of our listeners, some of our other presenters will have any sort of comments on, this whole AI artificial intelligence boom, and it fundamentally represents this a very problematic element of capitalism of this continuous need for growth.
So I also read that a lot of it is is powered by coal and gas, which of course explains why it is so polluting. But then I also have a question. Maybe Stephanie wants to say something, but I'll just pose this question: What do we do about it? What's the solution, Jacob? Or what alternatives do you suggest? But Stephanie,
a great question. Feel free to,
Well, I guess, the alternative really is, at the end of the day, we actually have to make a break from, we have to make a transition away from capitalism. The other thing as well, but in terms of practical measures, at the end of the day, the kind of growth imperative is very much driven by the commodification of these products.
Okay.
And, at the end of the day, we need to be actually fighting for measures that actually transition to make the transition to be away from profitability. Because at the end of the day, the fact is, obviously we're all reliant on laptops and smartphones, etc. But, we do live in a society where those things we could actually produce less of those things.
Yes.
Because of things like planned obsolescence, etc. And artificial, and this constant need to kind of constantly make the bigger, better things, actually kind of like that kind of need, we need to actually
and
put
sometimes
a hold
like,
on that.
Sometimes like a new iPhone is just a different colour, there's not many new features added. It's just creating, as you say, demand, artificial demand.
Oh, it's not completely true that it's just a new colour. There's all these other, that's what I guess.
But are they necessary? Like a lot of people probably wouldn't use.
Does it justify the climate impact?
I mean, I think that's more the question, not that they're not, because right now, phone tech companies are not just releasing aesthetically new things. They're packing their things with lots of different new features. Like, for example, the big thing with smartphones today is they're implementing artificial intelligence. So you have artificial intelligence be able to put effects on your phones, clearing up grain, etc. They'll have artificial intelligence being able to, you know, generate like your search results, etc. Maybe you'll have artificial intelligence that will control your TV or, you know, something like that. Like, those are all kind of features that they're sort of being, that are sort of being explored. Yeah.
Yeah. I've just got this really great quote, and I think it's a really good summary of the economic impacts of AI. But this is from it's from a social media page called Church of Jeff, but bear with me because I do think it's good. The underlying purpose of AI is to allow wealth to access skill while removing from the skilled the ability to access wealth. And I actually think that's a really succinct explanation of the impacts of AI, to be honest, on the working class and, like, and yeah, the horrible effects that it's going to have in terms of devaluing skill. And yeah, at the end of the day, it's just another way to exploit labor, really.
Yeah, and who produces all, like, there's a lot of child exploitation, just generally exploitation of workers, especially in the global south.
Absolutely.
For this kind of stuff.
Yeah, well, as we know, like, Apple have historically had some of the worst, working conditions. I think this is, even though, workers may, find that they need to use it for, because the requirements of their job are potentially going to increase because the assumption is that you start to use AI. It's interesting though, because, like, in my sector, we're actually not allowed to, because I work for a Department of Families, Fairness and Housing funded service, and so no, there's a blanket ban on using AI, whereas some other industries are probably being really pushed to.
And it's also it's also like part of what's been happening is pushing us to have mobile phones, for example. So I know you both know that I refuse to own a mobile phone.
And we love that, Mary.
Yep, but for all sorts of, I think, sensible reasons.
Yeah.
But, I had the luxury of being able to say no because I am now retired. And as a teacher for a long time, I wasn't required to have one. But my hubby and both and my brother, both who opposed mobile phones for a long time, were then forced to have them for jobs. And and the other way that we're forced to have them is that there are no longer any public phone booths around. In, you know, there used to be on every corner a public phone booth that people could use. Well, now
few and far between. They are free now, though. You can actually call national numbers for free,
but there's hardly any, and so people are forced to have things, and we're also forced into this technology. It's not something that we're educated, what is the best use of it, how can we really benefit from it, what things are beneficial and which ones aren't, and like we've just been saying, all of the environmental costs and the exploitation of people that goes with it.
Yeah.
Obviously, under a sane society, they would all be considered and somehow dealt with, but it's not happening.
I mean, I kind of want to add some salt in this because I guess I follow kind of the development of artificial intelligence quite closely. And I guess, I mean, one thing that is quite revealing about the irrationality of this sort of artificial intelligence push is ultimately you have all these companies kind of investing in artificial intelligence. Now, there's a few things that are happening. So the first thing is, ultimately, from the perspective of the billionaire class, they're ultimately putting all this investment in AI because it's going to create them profit. Like, obviously, the drive to accumulation of capital is obviously one of the main driving forces. But also, you have to think about, okay, so what is actually artificial intelligence actually offering? And now, in that critical kind of discussion, now, from the perspective of the billionaires, they sort of see artificial intelligence as, I mean, this is very much connected with how Marx has theorized about the development of capitalism. Capitalists with investment will always look for ways to save money on labor, like to make labor increasingly more productive, to be actually able to, to be actually to drive down costs, etc. So very much a lot of the big focus on artificial intelligence is ultimately driven by this aspect of, you know, trying to actually cut jobs, especially, yeah. And artificial intelligence actually represents quite a big threat to artists in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
Now, in some ways, you know, I'm not like opposed to use of artificial intelligence in terms of, you know, getting rid of the menial aspects of work, especially in terms of IT and programming. Like, obviously, there's certain utility in that, but I'm completely opposed to artificial intelligence being used to sidestep the need for having concept artists, even having voice actors and so on for, you know, whether it's video games, animated features, and so on. Like, that should absolutely be rejected. And I guess going into some of the solutions of the questions, that's where actually we need to make demands of states to put regulations on artificial intelligence, because the actual trend is they don't want to put any regulations on the use of artificial intelligence. And I think also another aspect is, I think the drive to artificial intelligence is also driven by this other kind of, you know, because obviously a lot of billionaire capitalists have their own ideology, they have their own, you know, philosophical viewpoints. So from the perspective of a lot of the ruling class, they see artificial intelligence as being this kind of thing of, oh, yes, we can resolve a lot of the contradictions and problems in society. Like, we can resolve the issues of climate change, you know, we can resolve the issues of poverty, we can resolve the issues of wealth distribution, because if we develop artificial intelligence, it will provide the pathway forward to this. And it's a fundamentally almost quite like a religious sort of idea. And it actually reminds me a lot of, you know, the capitalist push to around genetically modified GMO food, because ultimately GMO food and farming has actually pushed this sort of false idea that, oh yes, if everyone just adopted GMO technology, etc., suddenly we'll be able to grow more crops, we'll be able to we'll be able to solve world hunger, etc. But ultimately, despite those promises about GMO, all the promises of GMO have actually just amounted to dispossession of farmers, increasing the monopolization of big agriculture producers. And I think I would see artificial intelligence as following a very similar kind of trajectory. Yeah. There's all these false promises being made by the billionaire class, but ultimately it's all about simply enriching the billionaire class at the expense of the working class.
Yeah. But when you say they have their own old ideologies and, you know, they think that this is going to happen, I have the suspicion that they don't really believe that. They're just saying that to convince us to come along for the ride, but they themselves, most of them wouldn't give a two hoots. I was going to say something else. Two hoots about solving hunger in the world.
No, of course not. It's a rationalisation.
Yeah.
I guess the other aspect of AI, which I'm also quite concerned about, which we've already, it already exists on the internet and even like the algorithms and things with search engines, but it's just, it creates an echo chamber where it narrows the diversity of views and correct information, and it allows the ruling class to further control information.
And politically, it can be dangerous, because you can use AI to undermine progressive politicians by, you know, posing as them and them saying outrageous things or whatever.
Potentially, but it's also just like it's a potentially further way to control information, including scientific information and information that might, you know, be at odds with the interests of billionaires. So. Yeah, it's concerning for lots of reasons. I don't know that we can completely avoid it, like what Jacob's saying, but we should be demanding as a minimum that it's regulated properly.
Or just getting rid of capitalism, eh?
Yeah. We'll just do that.
I guess the thing is, because I think as socialists, you know, we're not opposed to the development of new technology. Because under a socialist system, you know, there are potential benefits that artificial intelligence could be used in terms of if it was actually directed by the working class and the oppressed. But ultimately, we live in a world where all these technological developments are being driven by, you know, capitalists, by the capitalist sort of mode of production.
Yeah, and AI is by no means under workers' control.
Yeah, so, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. Well,
discussion.
Yeah, well, good. I think this has been good discussion. Actually, is there a song that we want to play next?
There is, and it's going to sound very out of nowhere, but like I was sort of, I suppose, thinking about, you know, this time of year, and I was looking, There was one song in particular that I wanted to play, but I couldn't find it anywhere except on Spotify, which is really disappointing. But if any of our listeners do have Spotify, I encourage them to look up Katie Kirby, K-I-R-B-Y, and she does a song called Red Christmas, and it's really adorable. it's like,
is that the song you want to play now?
No, because like I said, I wasn't able to find it except on Spotify, but yeah. But the song I found instead was called, sorry, I've just lost my spot here. Okay, hang on. Sorry.
Yep.
Well, can I just say something while you're looking?
Yeah, yeah.
So I just wanted to give a encourage or urge listeners perhaps to consider writing to David McBride, the whistleblower who was just telling the truth and exposing what our government has been doing, and he has been imprisoned. And David Shoebridge from the Greens visited him recently and suggested that he's doing well, but that people might want to send messages of support to Shoebridge just to keep his spirits up.
Yeah, so I thought we'd use the last part of the program to kind of have to talk amongst ourselves between the presenters. You know, we've had another great year of, you know, radical kind of radio. You know, because this program has actually been going on since 2015, so that's actually been more than 10 years at least. Like,
wow.
Yeah, so more than 10 years. So this program, Green Left Radio, has been consistently going for 10 years. And I think it's been quite an incredible achievement. You know, we've gone through a lot of different presenters over the years. We've also covered lots of different, you know, we've consistently attempted to the best of our ability to cover all the protest movements, you know, to cover the stories of resistance against the rotten kind of capitalist kind of system. We've attempted to kind of pose grassroots solutions and socialist solutions to all the kind of issues. In fact, that was very much part of our big discussion we just had about artificial intelligence actually sinking through this kind of stuff. And also, I think, you know, we also present a counter to, you know, to the kind of corporate press who consistently often presents the perspective of the ruling class at the expense of workers. So I think, yeah, there's been, I think, this past year, I guess I wanted to kind of start off by, you know, talking amongst us about what has been some of the highlights of this year in terms of struggle and resistance. And I guess I'll kind of start off by saying that probably the biggest highlight for me, I think, was the strikes for Palestine that were led by the Italian dock workers, I think, which happened sometime around September, if I'm correct, September sort of period. I think that was definitely one of the more significant developments, because I think it very much showed, because very much in at Green Left, we are very much looking to the working class and the organized working class to be able to fight for fundamental social change. Yeah. And as kind of Marx kind of outlined in his work, you know, the working class are the most have revolutionary potential to be able to transform the system of exploitation. And I think The Italian dock workers strikes, I think, very much reflected that. And in fact, that was also, as we sort of reflect in the program, it was in the context of a fascist right-wing kind of government. The fact that these strikes were happened. The strikes also coincided with the Freedom Flotilla, probably the biggest Freedom Flotilla that actually happened for Gaza. And I think that was actually incredibly inspiring, some of the Freedom Flotilla. And, of course, we saw such a big outpouring of solidarity with Palestine around that. Yeah. And just actually, just for our listeners to be aware of, the next Freedom Flotilla is actually being planned for April next year. And they're very much trying to plan for a very big one to really put Palestine on the spotlight again. But yeah, I have some other reflections of the year, but maybe some of our listeners want to kind of add.
Well, can I? I think some of the election campaigns this year, like people may have forgotten, but the Left Party in Germany came back from what people thought was oblivion to actually getting a good result, especially in Berlin. And they had a great campaign leading up to the election results, which I think that for me was more inspiring than the result, although the result was really great too. And then, of course, there's the Mamdani campaign, and it followed a similar script where people went door knocking, and he was able to mobilise lots of working class people, including from the Southeast Asian community, who previously hadn't really been involved in American politics, but who were affected quite clearly by American politics negatively. And that I've just found his win so inspiring, and how he was able to unite so many people. And then, of course, there was our own election campaign here in Australia, and we did heaps of door knocking for Sue Bolton. I found that really illuminating, talking to people and how passionate people were about wanting to get progressive politics on the agenda. So that's just one thing. There's heaps of others. But Stephanie?
Oh, gosh. Well, I mean, I absolutely love music. And I think one of the highlights of being involved in this radio team is actually all the artists that we get to interview. And even though I don't think I was involved personally interviewing many, but I've listened back to quite a few. And so some of the interviews have included Tracksuit from The Herd. We interviewed Mud Rat recently. And just... and then I think last year we had David Rovics, who came actually in studio and did a performance. And, yeah, I think, yeah, the power of music and being able to communicate messages that way, it can really reach people in where, you know, any other form of communication may not. And there's also something powerful about music in terms of bringing, uniting people together as well, who, and yeah, empowering people. So I just wanted to kind of reflect on that too. I mean, other great moments, I've just really been enjoying the diversity of interviews that we've been doing as well, like especially some of the international ones that we did, like now I'm gonna get his name wrong because I think you organized this one, Drew Pettingrass, was that
Pendergrass
half Earth Socialism. And then we had like some recordings from the conference with some of our international speakers, and it's just so wonderful to get perspectives from all around the world. Oh, we had a bit of cross radio program collab as well with Phile, I think that's how you say it, Phile, the Italian speaking left wing program that's also on 3CR. We had one of their presenters on too to talk about the strikes in Italy, and just it's really, I think, and that's one of the powerful things about radio, and it's such a lovely community here at 3CR, is being able to meet people who you might not normally meet and build those connections, and to kind of unite together in the fight against capitalism and for human rights and human needs and environmental protection. So, that's some of my thoughts. Yeah,
absolutely. Yeah. I might just add, I interviewed Francis from What Were You Wearing? Because they were organising activities against domestic violence. Yes, that was in late November this year. I don't remember the exact date, I'm afraid. And I just found her to be a really inspiring young woman. And, of course, that group is led by Indigenous and young women. So, it's just excellent to see that there's, you know, parts of the women's movement in different forms to what it was in the 70s, but fighting back.
Yeah, for sure.
Well, some other things also that sort of happened. I mean, just trying to think about some of the stuff we sort of covered for Green Left Radio. But I thought we actually, we actually covered quite a lot. I can't think of any sort of interviews. Like, I think we did so much this year that I'm struggling. It sort of all comes a bit like a kind of blur. But we did, we did have some fantastic interviews with, some international guests, and then we also had a lot of local kind of guests and activists. I mean, consistently, I think some of the most important interviews we did were some of the interviews we did on the Palestine Solidarity Movement. So I think that was definitely great. And I guess, just some other political highlights from the year as well is that we did see a lot of mass protests and uprisings. So we saw mass protests in East Timor, Nepal, Indonesia. Yeah, so that some of those mass protests, I think, you know, while they haven't necessarily kind of amounted, you know, to big sort of radical changes, I think there were sort of very important kind of political kind of moments. Yeah. I also think some of the stances that the Colombian government has taken around Palestine, you know, which is, you know, relatively moderate sort of left-wing kind of government, has actually taken some very strong positions on Palestine liberation, which I think has been quite important in terms of the overall kind of struggle for a kind of free Palestine. Yeah. And, so I think, a lot of those developments have been, have been very kind of important. And I guess looking to the kind of next year, I mean, I think one of the most important things that we've got to really do is we've got to keep the resistance going. Yeah. You know, because at the end of the day, you know, capitalism is not going away. we actually have to fight for a socialist kind of alternative. We actually have to build the power of the organized working class. We have to build the power of the organized left. Yeah. And we have to give... And Green Left Radio will continue to be part of, you know, empowering that that resistance.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah.
And spreading the word and and linking up with other groups
making friendships and meeting new comrades along the way.
Yeah. Just a couple of negative things from this year, of course, was the horrible, horrible campaign against the CFMEU. That this so-called pro-worker government has initiated.
Yeah.
That was really disappointing to see and heartbreaking. Of course, there are still CFMEU people fighting on. Yep. Don't know how they'll go.
Yeah, some of the changes happened last year as well, but there were, I think, new measures, and again, now there's further pressure around restrictions around the right to protest, and of course, especially in New South Wales, but also in Victoria, there was a number of actions around that. And then also we've unfortunately had to have some anti-fascist and anti-racism
counter demonstrations, and so I guess the
rise of people are openly identifying as Nazis to the point where they literally will stand now on Parliament steps unmasked is quite concerning, and it is a development here. And and then of course we've got the recent although that wasn't related to Nazism, but extremism with the terrorist attack that we spoke about at the start of the program. But the far right is definitely growing in this country, and it's growing in other parts of the world, but so is the left, and so we've got to make sure that
In terms of negative news, I mean, I think really the devastating situation in Sudan is probably one of the more tragic things that has happened really in the past year. Currently Sudan is in the middle really of a civil war between two warring factions that are essentially there's no kind of good side and civilians and ordinary people are at the forefront. You know, there's mass starvation happening, there's repeated killings, you know, sexual assault, etc. It's a very devastating situation. I guess one of the more tragic things is Green Left Radio has regularly covered what's sort of happening in Sudan. And I guess earlier around 2019, there was a very inspiring kind of mass movement that very much took down the government. But ultimately, what has kind of happened since then is one of the compromises that the grassroots movement had to make. Was this kind of power sharing agreement with the military. And of course that has been very much the roots of this current crisis, because very much the civil war that sort of happened has been a result of one faction of the military kind of splitting away, and then they've opened up fire at kind of each other, etc. So yeah, there's a lot of Sudan is probably one of the more tragic sort of things that has really happened in this kind of past year. Probably one more event that I'm sort of more ambivalent about, because I think it's a bit more complicated, has been, actually, no, this happened more at the end of last year, actually, but at the end of last year, last year in December, we did see the overthrow of our Assad in Syria. Yeah. And now, obviously, the new government that has kind of taken power is obviously very mixed, and it actually remains to be seen whether this government will be worse or better than Assad. But I guess, I mean, the positive thing that obviously happened out of that was, I mean, I think the images of thousands of people being freed from prison, who were all imprisoned by the Assad regime, I think was ultimately, yeah, that is a positive kind of development. Yeah. But obviously there's a lot of questions that remain to be seen about, you know, the whole question of the Kurds, the whole question of minority rights within Syria.
Women.
And women, yeah. So I think there's... we still have a lot to kind of follow in terms of that unfolding situation in Syria. But that was sort of one of the more interesting things that has happened in the past year.
Yeah. So I think we probably should go to the activist calendar. Do we have an activist calendar for this week?
Well, there's not really much to highlight because we are getting into the holidays. Yeah. I mean, one event I just want to highlight is there is going to be a free concert today at one of the public housing towers called Rave for the Towers, and they'll be happening at 4 p.m. at Harmsworth Park near the Collingwood Flats.
Oh, excellent. We love a good rave.
Then I will just note that actually there were a number of events that were announced over the weekend, but a lot of them have been postponed. So there was going to be a gathering for Gaza in Port Melbourne, but that has since been postponed. There was going to be a vigil, Jews and Palestinians Unite Against Anti-Semitism and Genocide, but that has also been postponed, and that's going to be actually happening on Monday night, 5 p.m. at Parliament House, and it's specifically going to be focusing on the kind of anti-democratic laws that are being kind of pursued by governments. The other event I want to sort of highlight is the annual Resistance bookstore sale is actually still happening. So
lots of Christmas presents.
That's happening at the Resistance Centre on Friday and Saturday. So from 11 a.m. to 6 p.m. today, and then 10 a.m. to 6 p.m. tomorrow. So yeah, get along to the Resistance Centre, but it's like 25% off everything, and there's quite a large collection of books and so on.
Yeah. Books that you won't find in your regular bookstore either.
Yeah.
So that's great. All right. Is it time for the wrap up? I think we're just about.
Oh, yeah. Well, getting close to it. Was there a song people want to kind of play?
Oh, you want to play a song? All right. Have you got a short song?
let me see. What would be a good song to kind of end the program on?
Something positive.
Yeah.
A militant song? Do we have something, union song or something, Jacob?
Well, here's one. I could play a live recording of Joan Baez. Singing "We Shall Overcome."
Yeah.
All right, let's do that.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Well, I'd like to just thank all our listeners for tuning in this week. Have a good. Happy New Year, a good Christmas.
If you celebrate that or whatever you celebrate.
Yeah. We'll be back soon into the summer program that we have prepared for the next 3 weeks. And then we'll be back on the 16th of January next year. All right.
Fabulous. Bye.
Bye, everyone.
Okay, just need to quickly get this recording ready. Sorry, there's a bit of delay.
Sorry, some elevator music for listeners.
Yeah, we'll be coming soon. All right, here you go.
All right, take it away.
We're going to be listening to Joan Baez, "We Shall Overcome."
Enjoy. Bye.
Aren't we supposed to also say left?
We shall overcome. We shall overcome. We shall overcome someday. Oh, deep in my heart, I do believe.
Truth will make us free. Truth will make us free. Truth will make us free. Truth will make us free someday. Oh, deep in my heart, I do believe we shall. Afraid today. We are not afraid. We are not afraid. We are not afraid today. Oh, deep in my heart, I do believe. We shall overcome. We shall overcome. We shall overcome someday. Oh, deep in my heart, I do believe we shall.
This brings us to the end of the show. You have been listening to Friday Left Radio, brought to you by Green Left Weekly Newspaper, which brings an alternative source of information that puts people and planet before profit.
If you like our work, become a supporter from $5 per month at greenleft.org.au/support or free call 1800 634 206.
Arise, you workers from your slumbers. Arise, you prisoners of want. For reason in revolt now thunders, and at last ends the age of Khan. Away with all your superstitions, serve all masses.
Arise!
We'll change henceforth the old tradition and spurn the dust to win the prize. That's right, the commies are back. Reds underneath your beds and that crap.
You've been listening to a 3CR podcast produced in the studios of independent community radio station 3CR in Melbourne, Australia. For more information, go to allthews.3cr.org.au.